I guess I'm going to start. We're supposed to schedule to start at 22, and don't know if there's a session chair or not, so I'll just start with it. My name is Jeff Wozniak. I'm here to talk about dynamic abstract data types. And just a word of note, in spite of the name being the same and my affinity for Apple hardware, I'm not in fact related to Steve Wozniak. So, just because many people have asked, and I'm not.
The other Woz.
Yes, the other the Woz. And people sometimes call me that, but it, yeah. All right. I'm going to talk about object representation based on use and how I did this in. So at ILC in 2005, Richard Gabriel gave a talk entitled "Conscientious Software" that talked about how software should be conscious of its surroundings and responsible for itself. Now, it's an interesting idea, so I thought I'd take that and apply it to objects. And that's what dynamic ADTs do. By the way, I should say if my voice cracks or something, I have a cold. So it might happen somewhere. And I apologize.
If you stand sort of to your left, then the microphone will pick you up better.
So right here. Can you hear fine?
That's
okay. All right, I'll stay here. All right. So the question we have to ask here is, and the theme running in this work, is how can you bring the notion of adaptation and observation to objects, which is essentially a sort of form of feedback mechanism. You can think of this like profiling code, instead you're profiling data. And it brings a nice duality, actually, because Lisp code is data. So it kind of unifies the concept in a rather elegant way. So the question at this point we have to ask is, what can we gain by watching data? Why would I want to observe data in the first place? Well, this is something that humans do when we build programs. We use feedback from profiling and so forth. So why can't we do that inside a program? So let's see how it's possible to do that. So as an example, we've got some graphs. And this is a very simple example, but it's illustrated. The two graphs shown here, one's dense and one is sparse. Okay, I hope that's relatively visible. I guess it's thinner than I thought it was. Now, with graphs, there's two common ways to represent them. There's the adjacency matrix representation and the adjacency list. There are trade-offs, of course, in choosing one over the other. The adjacency matrix uses quadratic space and the number of vertices all the time, whereas the adjacency list is linear in the number of edges, and that's helpful when the number of edges is small. So for sparse graphs, adjacency list is good. For dense graphs, you probably want to use adjacency matrix. Other things that come into play are locality of reference with respect to, say, caching mechanisms in the CPU. In an array representation, the edges might be more, the data is probably going to be closer as you iterate through without having to worry about chasing pointers around so much with the linked representation, depending on how things are configured in the system. And generally, you have faster edge access with a adjacency matrix representation. So these are all things that we watch for and consider in data representation choice when we're making programs. But that's just, this is pre-known knowledge. There's also something you can say, there's a subset of the interface that interacts with this that works better with one representation than another. So as a really simple example, search might be very fast for some data structures, whereas insertion may be faster for another. So if you have a data object that's mainly being searched, then perhaps a representation made for search, or faster for search, is better. Maybe you don't have to choose, maybe your not looking at making a data structure that's good for all operations, it's only good for a certain subset, and those are the ones that are used. So if we watch an object, we might be able to see what subset is used the most, and then change it based on what ends up being the pattern of usage. Also, properties of the data can have an effect. In this case, we have a graph, the dense graph is undirected, so we might be able to take advantage of that and get rid of the redundant information in the matrix representation. You'll notice it's along the diagonal, you can either side it's symmetrical, so maybe you can take advantage of that. Another example might be with a set. If you have a set full of numbers, then you know that you have a total ordering over those numbers, and perhaps you can make use of that to, say, find the smallest element in the set. Now, normally, the smallest element is not an operation defined for a set, but it emerges when we know that the data inside supports it. So we could watch that trying to transpire. What's really nice about the DADTs, or dynamic abstract data types, is that you can define these constraints, you can define these conditions without having to write this into the algorithm itself. So that's one of the main goals of this work, is to try and figure out how to put these aspects in the code without having to write it into the algorithm, because putting that in the algorithm itself tends to make it more complicated. All right, so here's conceptually what this looks like. We have an interface with multiple implementations, and normally what you have is an object associated with a single implementation. So when you use that object for the interface, you know which implementation you're getting. But with DADTs, what we're moving toward instead is an object that represents any one of multiple implementations. So in this sense, it's a conceptual unification of the object to the implementations. All right. So the name of the paper was a "Don't Ask, Don't Tell" policy for data abstraction, and that's where this comes from. We don't really know what implementation we're using, and we shouldn't really care. So what this means is that we have to somehow deal with the objects, and we have to deal with the operations. So how are we going to do that? Well, with objects, there's going to be three conceptual things in each object. It's going to be a current representation, which is an instance of one of the implementations. This will be our actual data object that really holds the information that we're working with. We're going to have something called resources, and resources are data stores for measurements. It's where we put our observations. So as we collect information about something, we put them in resources. The third thing are triggers. Triggers are functions that detect a condition and then act on it. So resources are your observations. Triggers is your way to do adaptation. With operations, again, there's three conceptual things to take to consider. One is the actual operation itself. So this is the real work being done. If I have to do a union, or if I have to do a membership test on a set, then I'm going to run this test on the current representation inside my object. The other thing it has to do is take measurements. This means giving the resources something to store. And then we have to execute the actions. Well, I don't want to imply a temporal relationship between my points and what I'm saying, but these are the set of things we have to do. The last thing is the executing the actions, so detecting our conditions and then acting on them. So how is this going to work? Well, there's a small, simple protocol for doing this that I'm going to outline with a somewhat abstract way. We have an operation that returns a value. The first thing we need to do is figure out what the significant arguments are in this operation. The significant arguments are DADT objects that we care about for this operation. So DADT objects hold information that we're going to use. So now, the running of the operation itself breaks down like this. The first thing we're going to do is run the triggers. This is where we're going to detect our conditions and do something about it. And when those run, those are given the significant objects, or significant arguments, so that it can detect things inside them. The next thing we're going to do is take initial measurements. The initial measurements will might return an intermediate resource value, an IRV. These may be used later, so we have to store them. The next thing is the actual operation itself. This will produce the value that we're going to return eventually. Again, we have to store it because there's more to do afterwards. Next are the final measurements. And the final measurements might make use of these intermediate resource values. Now, the reason we have two measurement stages is so that we can detect changes, such as time and space, for example. We might measure the running time of a of an operation, or we might measure how much space was used up or saved. Could be just about anything. And finally, we return the value that we got earlier, perhaps with some post-processing that I won't get into. You can read the paper for more information. So at this point, we have defined a way to observe and alter the objects at specific points in a program. And those specific points are when we execute interface operations. Now, the next thing we have to figure out is how you actually define a dynamic ADT. What are the stages involved? And there's four main steps. The first is to figure out what you want to observe. And once you figure out what you want to observe, you define resources for those observations. Next, you ask how and to what you want to react. So what conditions are going to be, do you want to detect, and how do you want to react to those? For that, you define triggers. Triggers are the hardest part to define in this. They can be very complicated. And some of my examples that I've been working on, and you can do quite a bit. So you have to be careful. Next, you define a class, which is quite simple. And then you have to define operations. Now, operations generally are easily defined by wrapping current ones. And that's fine for most operations. There's corner cases, though, where things get kind of tricky. So you might have to re-implement an algorithm here or there. Again, you can see the paper for more information, but I'm not going to be able to get into all those details in this talk. Okay, for a quick, simple example, I'm going to show the basic layout of what would happen if you defined a set, a really simple set, a dynamic set, we'll call it a D set. With sets, what really affects the internal representation is what goes into the set. So if you're going to hold a set of numbers, it's going to probably be configured a bit different than sets for strings. Okay, especially if you use hash tables, which is pretty common. In Lisp, hash tables use the EQ, I call them EQ star functions, so EQ, EQL, equal, equal P. They're defined using those, and you might want to use different equal configurations for different types. It all depends on what your goals are. So to watch this, we're going to define a class called TypeCount, and all it's going to do is keep track of the types that are entered into a set. It's really a very simple class. After that, we're going to specialize predefined generic functions with methods that do the resource collection itself. So I would define methods for measure resource initial and measure resource final. These are predefined operations. I won't show the code because it's too lengthy and would be confusing. Next, we define a trigger. Now, the trigger is going to be really interesting. What it's going to do is check the set and the element being put into it and say, if the type of the element is, then everything's fine. I assume we've configured everything to work with it. If it's not, then we check this will work with the parameters of the set as it's been defined, namely how equality is checked. Now, how does it know what to pick? Well, I define a knowledge base that contains common situations that can be changed or updated by the user, and it will consult that when it finds a type that it's not familiar with, or a type that's not in the set, and say, that's what I'm going to use. So it reconfigures the internals of the set based on what's been put into it. Next, we have a class. So the defined DADT class macro is a wrapper for a def class, and So this one has no superclasses, no slots, no extra slots on what's besides what's already defined, and some extra class options, resources, which is type count, triggers, which is the insertion trigger, and a default representation, which I'm just going to call a number set for the sake of clarity. It's actually something else, but it's easier if I just call it a number set. So it's a set made for holding numbers. Next, we define just a. In some cases, actually, that's all you have to write. You omit the ellipsis there. This will define an operation. It's called insert element, and it's assumed to be a method on a pre-existing generic function. So this uses generic functions. It's possible to use functions, but more often than not, you're not going to. So I just made it work for now with generic functions. Okay, so we have our resources, some triggers, a trigger, the class, and our operations. So this is a really basic example of how it works, of what it looks like when you use it. First, we're just going to make a set. Put in the symbol S, and it says it's configured right now for number sets. We'll throw in some random numbers, fine, no problem. Now we're going to insert a string. And it prints a message saying that it's changing now to accommodate strings, and when it returns, the insert element returns the set that you've been inserting into. It now says it's configured for numbers and strings. Again, this is an oversimplification. There's different internal representations, but for clarity, I just call it number string set. What's important to note here is that I didn't have to say anything about how equality is tested for. I didn't have to give any parameters about making the set in the first place. This is really useful, especially if you want to make high-level interfaces for things. Fortunately, it has one major drawback, and that is when you put all this extra work involved, it's really slow. And trust me, it's beyond slow. You don't want to use it like that. It's handy when your set's really small, but when you use it in a larger program, it's just not going to be feasible. So how are we going to mitigate this problem? Well, let's take a look at the basic flow of control again. What's important to note here is that the actual operation is what we're really concerned about. This is pretty much necessary in every single call. So we want to figure out, therefore, how do we exert control over the extra work? Okay, the extra work being the triggers and the measurements. If we can figure out how to do that, then maybe we can solve our speed problem. The way we take care of that is with directives. Directives are just mappings of names to values. They're like mini and small and simple environments for objects. You can think of it kind of like a scratch pad. It's just information that I need to keep around, throw something in there that's particular to my space. This comes in two flavors, local to the object and global to the program. And because directives are just general name mapping of names to values, we're going to define some standard directives that control how the extra work is performed. So now, the extra work is going to be performed like this. We have our basic flow here. The first thing it's going to do is check the significant objects to see whether or not those stages should run. This checks, so that's the local directive environment, and it can either be T for do it, nil for don't, or if there's no value, then we check the global directive environment. And that can also be T, nil, but if there's no value, we'll assume it's no. So don't do it. This gives us four configurations. Either there's no value locally, and it's found globally, or it's found locally. So we're going to find out what the overhead is per function call in the simplest case. In the simplest case is when we have no resources or triggers. If we were to put resources or triggers on, it'd vary too wildly to make any conclusions because those are very dependent on the task at hand. So I ran these tests and I got something like this. Notice that's microseconds. You'll see that when it's set to turn it off, the overhead is not bad. except for CLS. And when it's turned off locally, it's very good. It's essentially a wrapper call. Okay, so SBCL is actually very good at it, it seems. It doesn't even show up. But essentially what we're doing is we're turning it into a wrapper call, which means the overhead's not that bad. So how do we go about taking advantage of this? Well, if you recall from earlier, we have triggers are actually given the significant objects. So what we can do is we can detect a condition and then turn it off local to the object. Now, doing so might require some heuristics, but if you can make them reasonable, it can be pretty useful. Might not cover all cases, but, well, don't always get every case anyway. So if you can make it useful to you, then perhaps this will be very good. So to give you an example of, I'm sure you can kind of figure out now that if you can figure out how to pick a decent heuristic and turn off the protocol locally to the object, it makes a big difference. And this is really useful, very configurable, because you have individual objects changing their state based on how they've been used. It's not globally to the function. It's local to each object. So here's a simple program. We have some set S, and we're going to try and compute S prime. And S prime is every element that's in S, that's a string, and the length of S is also an S. Sorry, the length of X is also an S. So we open a file that has our data. We make a set. Again, we don't have to say what's going to go into it. Then we just fill it with stuff by reading the file. And then we filter it. And filter is actually, if you read the paper, filter is actually a function that's specific to the dynamic ADT interface for sets, because it's really hard to write this in the general case. And it just filters out the elements that are strings and meet the conditions. So the heuristic we're going to use is, after 50 elements, after we've seen 50 elements, assuming an even distribution of the types of things in the file, okay, again, we're using some knowledge that we have of the data ahead of time, so this is not a panacea. It doesn't just figure everything out. But if you use some heuristics based on some knowledge, it can make things simpler. After we've seen 50 elements, we're just going to assume that, well, we've probably seen all the types we're going to see, and once we've seen all those types, then we don't have to worry about the trigger anymore, because the trigger only works for putting things in. So we'll just turn it off. We'll turn off the whole protocol, and just everything will be run as normal. So I did this in three ways. One with the function as is, by keeping the protocol on the whole time. One by using a heuristic, and a plain version, which is considerably more code, but I'm not going to show it here. And I only did it for numbers and strings in a file. And this is these are the timing results for that function run in a file with 100,000 elements. By the way, I use default compiler settings for all these implementations. You can see here, they all follow the same basic pattern. And the timing with the heuristic is more than the plain version, but it's not bad. It's pretty acceptable, I'd say. Still comes in under a second on all three, and I'll throw a CLSP in, but because the times are considerably higher, you don't get to see the subtleties involved in the other three implementations. So if you can come up with a decent heuristic, you might have a very useful interface. So by imbuing objects with some form of autonomy, even if it's not complete autonomy, we can facilitate adaptive object representation based on data profiling. And if your application is conducive to this, you can even get accepted performance if you just keep it in with your program. It would be more interesting to use this information to specialize the code later. And that's something I'm playing around with right now. So you can use this information to figure out what the code's going to look like in the end, and specialize it so that you don't even have any of this protocol overhead involved. And that's it. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yep.
Maybe just one thought. All your stuff pretty much sounds context-oriented. Maybe in the context they all sense. The only difference is that as a programmer, you don't want to write the context switching explicitly, but in some way it should be performed implicitly.
That's when I saw Pascal's talk on a tutorial, that's what I thought as well. I've been planning to figure out how to do that, because I think what he's doing is would be really good for this.
Any questions?
Yeah. So you mentioned the heuristics that you use to cut off the adapter, but does that mean that you're underlying that you have to be more careful when you're writing the underlying implementation so that they're never wrong?
You do have, yeah, you have to be
your
very
heuristic
careful.
Is wrong.
Yeah, you have to be very careful. It goes through a few iterations to figure out what's useful, but. Yeah, you have to be very careful. It's tricky, but ultimately, in the code on the code side, it's it makes for some really short code that's very concise.
Okay, more questions?
Could you maybe even use runtime statistics so that the heuristics are generated at runtime?
That's something else I'm working trying to figure out ways to do. Yeah. That's why I want to. The goal here was to not use any non-standard algorithms, but I'm trying now to adapt to different implementations, information that you can get from them.
Okay, cool. Okay, if there are any other questions, we can go to the next speaker.